From the Baltimore Sun, I'm Dan Rodericks, Sun columnist, and this is episode 453 of the Roughly Speaking podcast. Race remains the country's most vexing divide. It continues to simmer just below the surface of many facets of 21st century life, and all too frequently becomes a flashpoint. Donald Trump, the nation's 45th president, a Republican, has been called a racist.
Started his political activity based on this racist lie that our first black president was not an American citizen.
And as I record this show, the Democratic governor of Virginia faces calls for his resignation after admitting to having worn blackface in the 1980s.
The governor overwhelmed tonight by calls to resign, the list growing over a racist photo from his medical school yearbook. The image shows one man in blackface, the other dressed as a member of the Ku Klux Klan. Governor Northam first admitting he is one of the men pictured, then denying he's in the photo. Tonight, the governor is now...
A century and a half after the Civil War and the abolition of slavery, a half century after passage of the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act, America is still coming to grips with its long history of racism and racial segregation. In Baltimore, with its legacy of racist housing policies and white flight, the Urban Institute recently reported that poorer African American neighborhoods received far less investment from banks and real estate developers than did resurgent white neighborhoods. And while the metropolitan population is more diverse than ever, racial divides remain in plain sight. Today on the show, some of our history, a look back at the 1896 Supreme Court decision, a horrible decision, in Plessy versus Ferguson, that preserved and furthered racial segregation well into the 20th century. My guest is veteran journalist and author Steve Luxenberg. His new book, being published this week, is Separate, the story of Plessy versus Ferguson and America's journey from slavery to segregation. Steve joins us after this message.
Roughly Speaking with Dan Rodericks is brought to you by United Way. Whether it's helping a single mom in Dundalk keep her home or giving a bright student in Sandtown a chance to be his best, United Way fights for families. Help them win the fight. Visit uwcm.org/fight.
Steve Luxenberg worked for 6 years on his book about 19th century America and the decades leading up to the Supreme Court's 1896 landmark ruling that affirmed equal but separate in public accommodations. The book focuses on three figures in the Plessy versus Ferguson case: Albion Tourget, the writer and lawyer who argued against the separate but equal doctrine; Henry Billings Brown, the Supreme Court justice who wrote what is widely regarded, perhaps second only to the Dred Scott ruling, as the worst decision in Supreme Court history; and John Marshall Harlan, the justice who wrote the lone dissent in Plessy. Homer Plessy was the Louisiana man of mixed race who was arrested for trying to sit in a car reserved for whites on the Eastern Louisiana Railroad. Ferguson was the state judge who ruled against Plessy's appeals, essentially upholding the Louisiana law that required separate accommodations for blacks and whites on passenger trains. Steve Luxenberg's book has at the start a quote from the Reverend Martin Luther King, Jr. "Men hate each other because they fear each other. They fear each other because they don't know each other. They don't know each other because they can't communicate with each other. They can't communicate with each other because they are separated from each other." I don't usually ask this question of authors, but I am curious what brought you to this story. Why did you want to do this story?
Well, it seems to me that race is our national conversation. We are often talking about it, or we are often avoiding talking about it. And I just thought, once I started digging into, you know, authors dig into things before they make a decision. I didn't decide to do this book until I'd done a lot of research. This is a compelling story that needs to be told.
And you didn't want to just examine Plessy versus Ferguson. You dig way back to the very beginnings of, well, I don't know the beginnings, at least the 19th century story of separation in America, which goes back to a train line in Massachusetts.
There were 8 train lines by 1840 in Massachusetts that were operating passenger railroads. And only 3 of them decided that they needed to have separate cars. So it wasn't a universal custom. curious that even three decided to have that, because the Massachusetts Constitution says that blacks and whites are equal. But they decided this, and it was a company policy. It wasn't a law. Nobody required it. And the first confrontations were with the abolitionists who were riding those trains, because before the trains, they were riding horseback to their night meetings, and that didn't seem too much fun. And they were riding together, whites and blacks. There were more whites than blacks. But one of those black passengers, one of those black abolitionists, was Frederick Douglass, newly arrived in Massachusetts from his fleeing of slavery in Maryland. And the conductors had been told on the Eastern Railroad and on the New Bedford and Taunton lines, you can't let these passengers ride together.
One of the things about the book that intrigued me are these abolitionists. And when we get to the Civil War, abolitionists versus unionists, people who believed that the Civil War was to preserve the Union versus those who believed, like Lincoln did, that we had to end slavery during this time. But back in the 1830s and 40s, there was some ambivalence, no, about riding in the same train with black people?
In the 1830s, the abolitionists were the extreme. They were the ones who believed that you had to end slavery and end it now, regardless of the economic consequences, regardless of the turmoil that would have caused. End it now, right away. Then there were people who called themselves anti-slavery, who thought that abolition should occur gradually. The abolitionists didn't like that. Mm-hmm. And yet they were on the, quote, same side. And then there were people who said, well, that's happening in the South, not in the North. That's their problem, not our problem. I don't have anything to do with that. We have free blacks in the North. And then even in the South, a lot of people, I think, believe that slavery was so widespread that there were more slave owners than not. That's not true. But it was an economic system, and that's why the South held on to it. Also, there were people, plenty of people in the South and in the North, who believed that people of color were inferior to people who were white. So you had a lot of conversation, the same way we have a lot of conversation today. There are people who say, well, all lives matter, not just black lives matter. There are other people who say, we're not saying that all lives don't matter. We're saying that black lives are important because they're the ones who are bearing the brunt of this. That's the same kind of conversation they were having in the 1830s and in the 19th century.
Going back to that period again, weren't you fascinated that railroad companies imposed this on people? We don't want you riding. White people should not be riding in the same car with black people. Where did that come from?
I rode the train for 25 years to Washington, to my job at the Washington Post. I watched conductors going down the aisles between this mass of humanity. And as I started to do this research, I wondered how a conductor could possibly go down a railroad car and separate the passengers.
You mean to say you're black and you're white?
Exactly.
You're mulatto and you're whatever.
Yeah. Right? I couldn't imagine it.
Yeah.
So we have to put ourselves back into the time when there weren't railroad cars. There were stagecoaches. They weren't big enough to really have to ask the question, where do I sit? With whom do I sit? Do I sit in first class? Is there even a first class? American railroads didn't have classes the way English railroads had classes at the outset. Instead, some of these railroads decided that they would separate their customers. And it wasn't just people of color. If you were dirty or ragged, that was the language that the president used of the Eastern Railroad in testifying in court about the policy. We don't want the dirty, ragged, and people of color, he said, black, in the cars with the white passengers. This is what our customers demand. One fascinating thing is in Philadelphia in the 1860s, in the late 1860s, the streetcar companies decided to have a poll among their passengers about whether they wanted to ride with white or black passengers, except the only people being polled were white. And of course, most of them said, no, I don't want to ride with blacks. Blacks weren't asked whether they wanted to ride with white passengers or how they wanted to ride. So it comes from this feeling that there is a difference between the races. That feeling is, remember, among white people. And I don't think black people were asked their preference too often.
Even though I feel like I'm familiar with this history of our country, the obsession with separation. I can't walk on the same side of the street with black people. I don't want to have anything to do with them. I want complete separation. They might work for me. They might be a servant or something. I might see them on the street. But I don't even want to ride in the same train car with them. And then it was later codified as law. But anyway, it begins with this sort of obsession of separation. Was it based on fear?
I think it's largely based upon a feeling that if I'm superior to somebody else, then I'm better off. I have power. And after the Civil War, you know, one of the things that we talk about is the original Constitution. Should we pay attention to the original language of the Constitution? I don't really understand that debate. The original Constitution had slavery embedded in it. In order to decide about political apportionment, it was decided that slaves would be counted, the enslaved people of the South would be counted as 3/5 of a person to give the South something. It was a compromise so that they had some more power than the North, or equal to the North, because they had a lot more people, but they weren't being counted as voters. Then in 1866 and 1867, Congress passes 3 amendments, one abolishing slavery, the second establishing equal protection under the laws and due process and citizenship for blacks, and the third, voting rights for people of color. That is a revolution. That is a totally different constitution than the first one. So when you're talking about the Constitution, are you talking about the 1789 Constitution? Are you talking about the 1867 Constitution? And of course, it took a long time for people to come to grips with the fact that the federal government had some role in trying to establish equal rights for everyone everywhere. The 14th Amendment talked about the states. The states could not abridge the rights of the people of color who lived in those states. Well, corporations abridge people's rights. Individuals abridge people's rights. Should there be laws about that? And that was the argument for many years. It took until 1954 in the Brown versus Board of Education for the Supreme Court to begin to turn the tide against the idea that there was some legitimate discrimination, or that the government had no role in the discrimination that was occurring at the individual level and at the corporate level. So a company, yes, the company could discriminate. It could decide where to put its passengers.
And as time goes on, you get more and more court decisions in favor of this, in favor of separation.
Well, certified. That's right. One of the fascinating things about Plessy as a decision is in 1896, in May of 1896, when it was announced, the newspapers didn't give it much coverage. Plessy was not regarded as a major case because the Supreme Court had already clearly said what it thought about equal rights and civil rights, racial relations in earlier cases. Each case, of course, brings new arguments and new ideas, as Plessy did. Then after Plessy opened the door because the Supreme Court had not stopped segregation, not stopped separation. That was the term in the 19th century, separation, to other states in the South enacting their own laws. First there was Florida, then Mississippi, then Louisiana with these separate car laws, and then gradually almost all of the states of the old Confederacy enacting such legislation. As new cases came to the court in 1900, 1906, etc., all the way through the 30s and 40s, the Supreme Court did nothing to stop this and often cited Plessy as a precedent for what it was going to rule. And finally, in 1954, the Supreme Court unanimously said, no, we're going to stop this.
So Plessy was a lot more important than the newspapers acknowledged at the time or understood at the time.
Yes.
Yeah. We mentioned Albion Tourget is an interesting man. The other main character, I think, is Henry Billings Brown, who was the writer of the majority opinion in Plessy versus Ferguson.
That's right.
But the man I found most interesting was John Marshall Harlan and his evolution in the book. It's a fascinating guy. And back before when I was talking about a unionist versus an abolitionist, he was a unionist.
And he was not even anti-slavery. He grew up in Kentucky, and his father was a congressman for a couple of terms. He was attorney general. He was a major politician in the state. And Harlan had all the privileges that came along with that. Everybody knew his father. As a boy, he had his hair tousled by Henry Clay, who was the most famous Kentuckian at the time, ran for president, nearly won. And he grew up knowing that politics was in his future. In 1855 and then in 1859, he went on the stump for various candidates, and he ran for Congress himself as a pro-slavery candidate. But then when the Union started to disintegrate, he had to make a choice. Do I go with the secessionists? Can't do that. I think this is one country. We have to deal with our problems as one nation. I'm going to be a unionist. I'm going to raise a regiment of Union soldiers and fight for the preservation of the Union. And if Lincoln makes this a war for slavery, then I'm out. Now, he never had to come to that point, but to prove that he meant it, in 1864, after he had left the army because he had to go home to tend to some family problems, and that was a typical thing that happened in those days. People didn't stay in the army for the entire time. In 1864, as a private citizen, he stumped for the Democrat George McClellan against Lincoln and said, Lincoln had turned this into a war for slavery, and I cannot support that. After the war, Harlan, continuing his evolution, is Attorney General himself, and he opposes those Reconstruction amendments that abolished slavery, gave equal protection under the laws. Why? Because he said it was the job of the Kentucky legislature to do that and not the job of the Congress. Now, you can argue whether that's a dodge and he really was still pro-slavery, but slavery was gone by this time. He had, his own slaves had been freed.
Mm-hmm. So
I don't think it was a dodge. I think that he was still holding on to his previous view. But eventually, if you're going to be a politician in Kentucky, you either have to join the Democrats who were all the old secessionists, or you have to do something else because there was no place for him in the opposition, as he had been calling himself for a while. And he joins the Republican Party, which in those days is the anti-slavery party, and he converts, renouncing his anti-slavery views during his 1871 run for governor of Kentucky, a race that he knows he's going to lose, but he runs anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And in that race, he's asked by his Democratic opponent, why have you changed? I liked your views before. Actually said that. The Democrats saying that. I liked your views before. You were right before. Harlan, quoting his mentor, Henry Clay, paraphrasing him, said, I'd rather be right than consistent. So here's a case of flip-flopping. He's flip-flopped, but he's defending it and saying, I was wrong then, I'm right now.
And you picked Harlan to focus on because he ends up writing the dissent, the only dissent, in Plessy versus Ferguson.
Harlan gets on the court in 1877. At that point, he becomes the only dissenter in these civil rights cases. There's a famous one in 1883 called the Civil Rights Cases, or five of them that were combined into one case. There's several more, including one testing of Mississippi separate car law in 1890. And then there's the Plessy case that comes along. It's filed in 1893 and is finally heard in 1896 and decided. Harlan is a reliable vote. Turgay and his compatriots from New Orleans know this. The mixed-race group from New Orleans that bring the case. They know that he's going to be a reliable vote. But they don't really know how he's going to judge their arguments. They wanted to make it a 14th Amendment case. They also wanted to make it a 13th Amendment case. Henry Billings Brown and the majority totally rejected those arguments and said, this is a case about what Louisiana can do under its police powers as a state. And if they want to keep law and order, preserve the peace by separating the races, that's up to them. Harlan was horrified. He actually said in his dissent, this is a shameful day, and this ruling will be regarded as bad as Dred Scott was. Dred Scott was the ruling before the Civil War that declared blacks could not be citizens. This is as bad as the Dred Scott decision.
This is from Steve's book. Harlan had started his political career as a pro-slavery candidate. After the war, he saw the rise of the Ku Klux in Kentucky and elsewhere. Now he made a direct plea to the people who shared his skin color and heritage. Quote, the white race deems itself to be a dominant race in this country, and so it is in prestige, in achievements, in education, in wealth, and in power. So, I doubt not, it will continue to be for all time if it remains true to its heritage and holds fast to the principles of constitutional liberty. But in view of the Constitution, in the eye of the law, there is in this country no superior, dominant, ruling class of citizens. Our Constitution is colorblind, and neither knows nor tolerates classes among citizens.
You know, John Kennedy quoted from Harlan's dissent in his 1963 speech saying he was going to go for a civil rights bill.
My fellow Americans, this is a problem which faces us all, in every city of the North as well as the South. Today, there are Negroes unemployed two or three times as many compared to whites. Inadequate education, moving into the large cities, unable to find work, young people particularly out of work without hope, denied equal rights, denied the opportunity to eat at a restaurant or a lunch counter or go to a movie theater, denied the right to a decent education, denied almost today the right to attend a state university even though qualified. It seems to me that these are matters which concern us all, not merely presidents or congressmen or governors, but every citizen of the United States. This is one country. It has become one country because all of us and all the people who came here had an equal chance to develop their talents. We cannot say to 10% of the population that you can't have that right. Your children can't have the chance to develop whatever talents they have. That the only way that they are going to get their rights is to go in the street and demonstrate. I think we owe them and we owe ourselves a better country than that. Therefore, I'm asking for your help in making it easier for us to move ahead and to provide the kind of equality of treatment which we would want ourselves. To give a chance for every child to be educated to the limit of his talents. That the law will be fair. That the Constitution will be colorblind, as Justice Harlan said at the turn of the century. This is what we're talking about, and this is a matter which concerns this country and what it stands for. And in meeting it, I ask the support of all of our citizens.
We'll continue our conversation with Steve Luxenberg, author of Separate, The Story of Plessy versus Ferguson and America's Journey from Slavery to Segregation, after these messages.
Roughly Speaking with Dan Rodericks is brought to you by United Way. From housing and education to healthcare and employment, they will help you fight to make the biggest difference in your community. Join the fight at uwcm.org/fight.
Hey, listeners, during the run of the 2019 Maryland General Assembly session, you can get updates on news from Annapolis on the Roughly Speaking Government Edition. Sun reporter Luke Broadwater and Malia Cromer, director of the Goucher Poll at Goucher College, are teaming up to file reports. So be listening for the Government Edition of Roughly Speaking each week until the end of the Maryland legislative session.
Roughly Speaking with Dan Rodericks is brought to you by the Ivy Bookshop, an independent bookstore at 6080 Falls Road, located at the intersection of Falls Road and Lake Avenue in Baltimore. The Ivy stocks a wide selection of books covering Baltimore and the Chesapeake Bay region, many by local authors. More information can be found at theivybookshop.com or by calling 410-377-2966.
I was going to ask you to describe Tourget's argument based on the 14th Amendment. It's a really interesting approach that he took, claiming that being white had value, that it was in a sense property. Skin color was property.
He knew that the court was dominated by justices who cared about property rights. So here he was making an argument about property, not about color. Your race is your property, he said. And who in America would want to be black if you could make a choice? We all see that white people are treated better, have wealth, have status, have privilege. If you could be white, you would want to be white. And if you can pass for white, as Plessy could, because he was so fair-skinned as to cause confusion, they had picked him for just that reason, to be the person arrested, you cannot deny to him the property right to pass for white and to get some economic value out of that reputation.
You couldn't do it without due process.
Right. You couldn't do it without due process. Right. Now, if you're listening to this argument and you're a person who is skin color is quite dark, darker than Plessy, this isn't making you feel too good, this argument.
Right.
Because, as I say in the book, Plessy might be graduated to the white car, but where does that leave? Still leaves separation in place. So it's a very risky argument. But he wanted to win.
Hmm.
Didn't work.
Right.
But it was one of the many arguments that he proposed. But the 14th Amendment was his touchstone. He kept going back to it. He felt that the previous cases that the court had looked at, in which they had narrowed the definition of the 14th Amendment, that the facts of those cases did not give rise to the arguments in this one. A conductor walking down a car could flag a person under the law in Louisiana and say, You're in the wrong car, and if you refuse to go to the other car, I can charge you with a crime. Who makes a conductor a prosecutor? A police officer? Where does that come from? He wanted them to deal with that issue. And Brown said in his decision, the question of what constitutes color is somebody who is from parents ending up essentially one quarter black and three quarters white. There's no definition for that in Louisiana. That's an issue that another court may want to address.
Because there's no definition for it in the law in Louisiana.
There was no definition for what in Louisiana for what constituted color. And Plessy and his co-counsel, James Walker, hammered at that point. James Walker wrote a whole treatise about the definition of color in many states. In Michigan, it was one thing. In Georgia, it was another. What definition are you using here? Court ignored that and said, another case, another time.
You mentioned Frederick Douglass earlier. He didn't think Plessy versus Ferguson was a good idea. He didn't think this particular case was winnable.
We have what he thought through the very disappointed eyes of Louis Martinet, the head of the New Orleans Committee to test the constitutionality of the separate car law. Martinet and his committee had asked Douglass for his imprimatur. I think there were two possibilities. One, Douglass saw this as a losing case, and he was right. And two, maybe he didn't want to throw his lot in with this mixed-race group from New Orleans, which was very different than the constituency that Douglass had spent his life advocating on behalf of. Whatever his reason was, he did not give them his blessing. And Martinet, as I said, was not only disappointed, he was angry enough to tell Turgay in no uncertain terms that this was a big nadir in his life.
As time went on after Plessy, well, we know the hit from the history in the South, lynchings increased in the late 19th and early 20th centuries. It would seem to me, even for a Supreme Court case that didn't get a lot of attention at the time, as time went on and it was brought up and used in other cases, or it was just held as doctrine that we're going to have separation of this country from now on, do you feel like it must have contributed to the violence against black people in the South?
Oh, I think there were many, many factors that contributed to the violence. And the violence, the violence begins in the 1870s. In 1875, when a federal judge looking at the new Civil Rights Act that mandated equal accommodations without regard to color, he was troubled by the law. He thought it was unconstitutional. But he said, this is not an act that I care a lot about. I mean, whether blacks can go to the theater doesn't really concern me when we have innocent people being dragged out of their homes and beaten and killed for no reason. That's what was going on in 1875 when he's giving his instructions to a grand jury. Lynchings begin in the 1880s. There aren't as many as there were in the 20th century, but they begin. And by 1919, 1920, when the NAACP puts an ad in the newspaper, The Shame of America, they say there have been 3,800 lynchings since 1880s. Mm-hmm. The Chicago Tribune begins to keep a count. It publishes an annual report on how many lynchings there were and where they were. Ida Wells, a crusading journalist, black crusading journalist, inspired in part by the newspaper columns of Albion Turgay, who railed against lynching in the pages of the Chicago Inter-Ocean, a paper that no longer exists, but which saw itself as unifying the country, the Inter-Ocean, from one sea to the other in the city of Chicago. His columns were so popular that the Chicago Inter-Ocean had a large subscription base in the South where people of color bought subscriptions just to read Albion Turgay's column.
The Bystander.
The Bystander.
Yeah.
And then Ida Wells, inspired by Turgay, we know this because she writes to him, begins an anti-lynching campaign of her own, which establishes her as a major voice for people of color. The 13th Amendment, in addition to abolishing slavery, said that it was now unconstitutional to inflict a badge of inferiority, a badge of servitude on anybody. Turgay interpreted this to mean that sending someone to a separate car was stamping them with a badge. Henry Billings Brown thought that was ridiculous. He said, this is an amendment about slavery and nothing else. John Marshall Harlan embraced it. He said, this is exactly right. What else are we doing here? We're not doing this to send white people to a separate car. We're using this to get black people out of the white car. But that's why these laws that were passed were so insidious, because in the preambles of the Mississippi and Louisiana laws, it said that we're establishing equal but separate accommodations for white and black passengers. White and colored passengers was the language. Well, that gave the guise of equality to it. It was a veneer. But it says, first of all, white people are saying, some white people, you're inferior. You belong in a separate car, in separate bathrooms, with separate water fountains, in separate waiting rooms, separate schools. What else are we to think?
Right.
And so why not commit violence against people who are lesser than I am?
Inferior.
And what is that violence all about? You used the word anger and fear before. It's a way to maintain power. I'm afraid of the rise of black power in places where there are substantial black populations. I'm going to keep them down. I'm going to maintain my political power. In the Reconstruction period and afterwards, Louisiana had more black voters at one point than white voters. This was pointed out by the New Orleans Times Democrat as a warning to white people, if you don't think this is a problem, look at these numbers. So what do? Well, you enact laws that prevent people of color from voting. And that's what happened. That's what started to happen. That's a kind of violence, too, I would argue. It's not physical violence, but it's violence against the political rights of people who had been assured by the Constitution that they now had them.
What, for you personally, was the most significant thing you learned?
I wanted to understand. That's a key word for me. As a journalist, when somebody once said, what you do is get to the bottom of things.
Mm-hmm. Or the back.
Or the back.
The back story, right?
But I wanted to understand, how could these very contradictory men, this pro-slavery candidate for Congress, end up being the dissenter? How did Henry Billings Brown, who was raised in an abolitionist neck of the woods in Massachusetts, how did he end up being the author of this bad decision? Where did they come from? What was the arc of their lives? I don't believe that we can look at snapshots and understand history. So I wanted to go back, and it is an ambitious book. I mean, I'm asking you to buy into this idea that the 70 years that precede Plessy matter, and that you need to follow along with me. You need to see the roots of racial separation. You need to see the roots of resistance. You know, Plessy was a member of a community that was largely free all during the 19th century. And they had been promised in the American takeover in 1803 of Louisiana, they were promised their rights. They didn't get them then. They didn't get them in the 1860s. They didn't have them by the 1890s. And they were one frustrated, angry group of people by then, and they weren't taking it anymore. But they had predecessors. William Nichols, New Orleans, 1867, decides he's not going to ride the black car, the star car, they called it. They actually had black stars on them, the street car. He was going to step onto the white car and make them throw him off, which they did. And he happily went down under the grip of a police officer to the court to state his case. There are many stories like William Nichols in the book, because you can't get to Plessy without understanding those stories.
Equal before the law is equal before
equal
the law.
Equal protection under the law.
Equal protection under the law.
Or of the law.
Right.
The constitutional historian is going to...
Okay. Well, whatever it is, again, it's meaning, right?
Right. Important
why doesn't that prevail? Why doesn't that defeat equal but separate?
The Supreme Court... Now, we know that the Supreme Court in 1954 and since has said that was an erroneous reading. Huh. But what they said is that it's not equal protection under all the laws everywhere all the time. It's only when the states have enacted discriminatory legislation. So the fact that they put the word equal but separate accommodation for white and colored passengers into the law means that it is equal protection. Now, that's a interpretation we reject wholeheartedly today. And as we know, the Supreme Court said in 54, separate is inherently unequal.
Well, it's interesting to think about all this in light of where we are today. We're still struggling with these issues. There's a story in the Sun about an Urban Institute report on where investment and redevelopment and bank loans have taken place in Baltimore City. And it looks to somebody who has some perspective, it looks like redlining remains. So we're still struggling with separation.
Well, I think that you've written a lot in your columns about inequality, about the differences in the wealth, education, and status of white people versus people of color. The statistics, we're not talking about an argument here, the statistics show that people of color lag way behind in wealth, in the accumulation of wealth. That comes from somewhere. White people have had wealth for generations. In America, the country prevented people of color from having wealth. They prevented them in the 19th century from having education. I mean, in slavery days, of course, you weren't allowed to be educated, but even after that, there weren't schools, or there were inferior schools, or there were prohibitions against going to school in certain areas. All that contributes to the failure to be able to make it on equal terms with whites. Now, today, I think, I hope, I pray that we have a different view. But we're still dealing with the legacy of those generations of not having allowed that to happen.
Steve Luxenberg has been a senior editor of the Washington Post for many years, and he is a former reporter and editor for the Baltimore Sun. His first book was Annie's Ghosts, A Journey into a Family Secret, published in 2010. His latest is Separate, the story of Plessy versus Ferguson and America's journey from slavery to segregation. Steve Luxenberg will be in conversation with Judge Robert M. Bell, former chief judge of the Maryland Court of Appeals, at the Church of the Redeemer, that's at 5603 North Charles Street, and that's at 7 p.m. on February 13th. The Ivy Bookshop will have copies of the book for sale at a book signing following the program. I'm Dan Rodericks at the Baltimore Sun. From my trusted and skilled producers, Steve Early and Hallie Miller, thanks for listening to Roughly Speaking and for supporting the Baltimore Sun.
Roughly Speaking with Dan Rodericks is brought to you by the Ivy Bookshop, an independent bookstore at Falls Road and Lake Avenue in Baltimore. The Ivy stocks a wide selection of books covering Baltimore and the Chesapeake Bay region, many by local authors. Located at 6080 Falls Road, more information can be found at theivybookshop.com or by calling 410-377-2966.